Hi, everyone, and welcome. This is JJ Walsh here in Hiroshima, and another episode of Seek Sustainable Japan. This time, this is some audio from my trip to the amazing 2025 MinkaCon, which was held in Aichi. So I'll be sharing some of the audio from the videos that I took live while I was there. And first, we have the amazing Asby Brown, designer, architect, author, teacher, who has spent many years passionate about preserving traditional design. This talk, he shares some of his insights about how we connect as humans to things in old traditional houses like Minka, which are handcrafted. It was a beautiful presentation. I will also be putting the video version, if you want to see the images that he shows while he's talking, up on my YouTube channel, so you can check that out later. But I hope you enjoy, and I hope you get inspired as much as I was.
I think a lot of us are attracted to Minka and historical architecture and reusing buildings and even environmental practices, farming, etc., because they represent alternatives to our dominant ways of life now, very industrialized, very commercialized. And all of us are looking for something more, something different, something more. And when we think about preservation, often we tend to focus on the stuff, the material, the buildings, the hardware, that stuff. But I want to dwell a bit today on what else we should want to be preserving, what else is important to preserve, which may be ways of thinking, ways of sensibility, ways of understanding as well. And I always try to start with the question, who is it for? And I think as we go, we should be thinking about this. So many things happen in our societies. And you say, who's this for? Who's benefiting by this? Maybe it's financial interests or political interests or other people. But when we think about things that should be done that may help more people more broadly, I think our perspective changes. And maybe I'm not alone in thinking that so much of the beauty and meaning of Japanese buildings is rooted in the human hand, rooted in how they're made, rooted in the handcraft aspect and the expression and use of the hand. And maybe I'd like you to dwell for a few minutes. If we think of something like if you peel an apple, to sort of picture that, in your mind, try to feel that, what are you feeling? Well, sure, the weight of that apple, its temperature, maybe it's just out of the refrigerator, it's a bit chilled. Maybe the surface is a bit moist, there's a bit of moisture on it. And then you're using your knife, and you're peeling it, and you feel a bit of resistance from the flesh of the apple, or maybe the knife slips when it goes on the skin. And you're rotating this apple simultaneously as you're managing to use the knife at the right angle, subconsciously, basically, peeling that apple. And it's something you can do while talking to somebody, where you don't have to be 100% focused. You can be doing this. It's kind of remarkable, this mundane thing that we do day after day, and our life is filled with these things. The hand is really marvelous. We have all of this information coming in. Hands, incredible sensor. And we get a lot of information from it, but it also allows us to act upon the world, to make things, to change things. I think about, Japanese arts, Japanese building, things related to that in relation to the hand. And of course, we'll look at carpentry a bit. This is something that most of us are almost mostly interested in, is the carpentry side. But it's not just carpentry. And this photograph is not that old. And there's the woman, and she is, you see behind her is the takekomai of the wall, which is going to be plastered with clay soon. And she's making, hard to say what that is. Maybe it's Mushiro is not a goza, it's something made of straw woven. And she's probably doing a lot of these. She has a little frame and the implements to keep the strings taut. And I would just point out that this is a very, very ancient, technical way of doing things. I mean, really prehistoric. People were making these kind of things in the Neolithic period. You look at this is a Meiji period photo of a Sajiya-san, a blacksmith. And again, so this is sort of Iron Age culture. And if you've seen these guys at work, maybe you have or maybe you haven't, it's kind of frightening because they're hitting so hard, you know, and their fingers are right there and they, you know, they don't miss very often. And it's hot. They have to deal with this incredible heat on this metal at the same time and very delicate, capable of great power. The hand lends great power and also great accuracy and delicacy. And even mundane things like this woman who's using the mill to probably mill whole rice or something. The house itself is very old. It's got kayabuki and the wall is tsuchitabe, and we see other things around it. There's a great continuity, of course, throughout the Meiji period with previous eras. I like that this sort of chicken is over here, but the exposure is kind of long, so the chicken's apart. So yeah, kind of a life there. When I was researching and Yakushiji, of course, spent a lot of time in the workshop observing the carpenters at work. This is, you know, one carpenter and just doing typical carpenter work for a miyadaiko and Yakushiji. They didn't particularly show off like their how thin their shavings were. That was just the work, you know. But you can understand the focus and I really love how the body is brought to bear. The stance of people is brought to bear so that the hands can be used in the way they want to use it. Here's an older carpenter using a chona. This kind of delicate work, you know, describing the sumi. This kind of tutorial-san, this laying out the kata. This was a very, very young carpenter, a teenager, really, just out of junior high school. And Master Nishioka thought he would be very good at doing the very detailed work. And he really was. He was 16 years old, doing these wonderful, wonderful carved details and great delicacy and great concentration. Here again, I just notice how the bodies, the way they're standing, is all in order to, and almost subconscious again, how to put their hands in the best position and bring the force to bear, the power to bear on the work they're doing. This is a photo, you know, a little detail. People know Kawai Takami in Kyoto, who does workshops for among Japanese, just sort of showing simple chisel work. And this is John Sollermeyer, beautiful, you know, plain work. And again, the hands are so expressive, but when we are using the hands, we're almost, again, subconscious most of the time. We're sort of automatic, a little steeper, a little harder, a little deeper, a little something else. And they leave a record, which is really one of the important things. Here's, I hope Takeshi-san's not embarrassed, but maybe some of you have been to his wonderful Shiguchi-do, Museum of Shiguchi in Kamakura, and here he is looking very serious. Of course, he displays them as sculptures, and they really are remarkable. Maybe the photo's not quite sharp, but it's full of the record of the movement, the gestures, the carving, how the carpenters were using their tools, using their hands. It's really speaking, not just the form, but it's really speaking to us of how it became this. Of course, this is a fairly large beam, and there were some really, really big beams in old Japanese houses. This is a Mantaki Bashira, forked tree column, which is not that common, but it's just immense. Sort of becomes the Daikoku Bashira of this house in Yamagata. And again, we're interacting with that. We're finding a way to shape that using our power, using our tools. Maybe people know this gigantic saw called Maibiki Oba, which they're not in common use anymore. But this photo is also not that old. I'm not sure exactly when it was, but based on what they're wearing, this is Showa period, I think. And even this kind of saw could be used very, very accurately. A lot of power required, a lot of strength, a lot of muscular, you know, strength. But at the same time, you know, our hands are doing these things very, very delicately, like making kumiko for shoji. And again, these things become specialties, a special shogunin doing shoji, doing kumiko, doing things as opposed to sawing logs, or as opposed to, basically making components to kodaiku work. The hand is really capable of great delicacy as well. And, I want to talk a little bit more about that and why. I don't know if you people know, I have a laboratory as part of Kazuo Kogyo Daigaku. My laboratory was in Tokyo for 10 years, called the Future Design Institute. And I was, I realized that a lot of people in institutions, in education, in government, throughout society, even in industry, they just didn't get it, why hands are obviously so essential for learning, communication, et cetera, for culture. I realized we needed evidence, so I spent pretty much 10 years doing research with neuroscientists, etc., on the hand, on perception and things, and ended up learning a lot. And one thing that I learned from other great scientists is that the strong theory is that human brains got big because of our hands in this sort of interplay. Our hands, in order to be able to use our hands better, we needed bigger brains. And this is connected with standing upright on two feet. We can see better when we're upright compared to primate that's on the ground. And being able to do things with your hands required bigger brains. And also for language, that language really seems to have started with hand gestures before we were actually able to vocalize language. So being able to make explicit gestures. So these things are all connected. The hands are really kind of part of your brain. And, most of it happens in your skin. This is a crazy thing. We think of skin, it itches, it's cold, goosebumps, but the skin is this gigantic sense organ that covers your whole body, and the hands are particularly important. And there's all kinds of stuff in your skin. There are, of course, the things that detect temperature and the ones that detect pain, but there's particular ones that detect touch and pressure, a deep one for pressure, a surface one for touch, these things are all connected to a part of your brain called the somatosensory cortex, which is right here. And the thing that kind of amazed me was I learned that it's all mapped. Like these parts of your brain, the somatosensory cortex, like they figured out over the last century, which parts of your body, the nerves, the sense nerves are connected to which part of the brain. And we know this, and you can map it in your hand. Hands have a big, big area of the brain for the touch, those areas. And in fact, you may have seen this funny image before. It's called homunculus. This kind of goes back to Faust and those things, but showing the relative size of the area on the brain that is related to the sense receptors in different parts of your body, and the hands are really, really big. They have a lot, and the mouth too. The lips, of course, super, super sensitive mouth. Our brains are like really, really important for driving our hands, and our hands are really important for making our brains. We know that other animals can make things, can do things. This is a chimpanzee painting. We've seen other animals being shown how to paint, being taught how to paint, and many of them really, really get into it. This chimpanzee seems to be, they often do this for tourists, and it's kind of a sad in a way, but sometimes they are very, very self-expressive. And he can paint, and the hands of other primates, they're pretty similar to ours. This is human, and this is chimpanzee, orangutan, baboon, it's four fingers and a thumb, but they work differently, this is a human, actually a chimpanzee. If you look more closely, this is a chimpanzee holding a stick in different ways. They have these various grips that they can do. If one thing you might see that the thumb is pretty skinny, pretty small compared to the human, and they can hold these things in various ways interlocking them, you know, in their fists, in their fingers and stuff. But they can't do this. There's several things that humans can do that our hands evolved to allow us to do that other apes can't do. And one of them, this is what we call the three-finger clutch. So we can do this with our fingers, which means I can hold this pen and rotate it. You know, I have this fine control. I can hold my pen or tool or scribe tool with this precision grip. You know, this is something that apes can't do. And the other thing, you know, apes can hold a stick like this, but they can't hold it like this, where that the stick or whatever is the same line as their arm. So that means humans can throw things better, can beat things better, can use hammers, can use all sorts of tools in ways that apes are not capable of doing. And this is all built into our bodies. We evolved this way, and I think we're still evolving. So I look at this this chimpanzee, and sure enough, look how he's holding the brush. You know, he can't really hold it like we would hold it, but he's able to do some great control. There's other animals, you know, who make things. I don't know if you know the wood dauber wasp. The mud dauber wasp. They make these little nests for their eggs. They look like beautiful little pottery, you know. This is how they start, you know. They make a ring of the mud, of the clay, and they keep going around, 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 and eventually it has a narrow opening, and then they lay the eggs in there, and then they put in some food for the babies, you know. And it's kind of incredible that they make these wonderful things. The world, natural world, is full of things made by other animals. Birds' nests, all sorts of things, which are wonderful to look at, we learn from. And we think of them differently, though, that those animals somehow are programmed to make those things and only those things. You know, they don't have a lot of repertoire, a lot of way to diverge from these single patterns, although there are, it does happen. And I think of this as natural emergence, you know. This is in the world, even without humans, and something very, very precious for us to continue to learn from. But humans, of course, we have this power of visualization, where we can imagine things that don't exist yet. And figure out how to start with this stone and end up with a sharp tool, and to predict those steps, this process. And so much of what we're doing is using this visualization to especially relating to our hands and fabrication, how much force, how much time, how much, you know, size, et cetera. We can predict this. We do this constantly. Throughout our lives, even when you're cooking, when you're tying your shoes, almost anything else. So it seems to set us apart. We can't get into animals' brains enough to know exactly what's going on for them, but we know what's going on with us. And it's amazing that throughout the world we've come up with so many sort of similar approaches, like pottery, ceramics is a wonderful thing, global. This one is from Peru, pre-Columbian Peru. I love it. This little spirals, you can sort of imagine the person with their finger making that. And this is from Southwest United States Indigenous Americans. It's painted, and this one is Japanese, but not antique. It's a fairly recent tsubo, done in a traditional style, which I love. It's sort of a perfect form for warm sake, right? You hold that, the neck doesn't slip because of that little lid, and then it fits your palm, and you can imagine it being very, very warm. And of course, can you see the glaze? It's got kind of a gritty surface to it, and you can feel that grit in the palm of your hand. It's kind of wonderful. And I'm fascinated by things like this. This is a vase by Kawai Kanjiro, a famous potter, Kyoto-based. His house is a museum in Kyoto. I urge everyone to go see it. And he was part of the Meiji movement. So the movement to, you know, sort of reestablish traditional crafts as a high level of art. And what I love about it is, well, it evokes, of course, ocean waves. You know, it's water, it splashes, it's waves. But we can all tell that's his fingers. He went, lip, lip, lip. You know, we can see how he did that. you know, and it was kind of these quick gestures, you know, to smush the clay to make those grooves and ridges. So, and we know this is made by a human being. We can see that. And how do we know that? How do we know that? And one big theory is something called mirror neurons. So in our brain, we have a system that is essential for learning how to do things, allows us to mimic people. So if Takisa raises his hand, a little baby will go like this too. If I see someone reaching into a cabinet and I know that they're grabbing a plate, that we reproduce in our mind what other people are doing and sort of experiencing it. And I think this also works with things that we are encountering in the world, that possibly mirror neurons are activated when we're seeing something made by hand, or when we see anything, and they're activated and we're reading that it was made by somebody. So this is a kind of roughly carved wooden bench, an oak bench, and it's kind of chunky, and you can see these marks from the chisel and the wood's, you know, flaking off and things, and it's very evocative. You can really see a lot of hand energy there. But even in something like this, this is a carving from a stained church in Norway, 1500-year-old or so church. Again, much finer carving, but we still can imagine that artisan, how he's moving his hand to make these curved cuts, etc., how to chop down through. Or maybe just take a totally different example, this drawing by Michelangelo. It's a study for the Sistine Chapel, and he's like trying out a lot of stuff. A lot of things happening. Does the hand go this way? Does it go that way? Some things are more firmly drawn. Some things are more delicately drawn. He's got some scribbles. They've got some smudges. He's got a few different kinds of toes. And the drawing's kind of big. These are big. So it's actually his whole arm moving when he's doing that. And, you know, this is incredibly evocative for us. And I, you know, not to be too analytical, I want to call attention to the fact that it's a high order of information, a lot of information about everything. The record of the decisions he's made, indication of his physical limits, you know, how big, how hard he can move his hands, etc. The interaction with the natural world, with the materials, with the chalk, with the paper, and suggestions of an emotional state. We read that into that. How was he feeling when he was doing that? And then the basic human story. And this leads me to the suggestion that humans, all of us, subconsciously try to detect the human connection, the emotion first. Because we are social animals. We depend on social interaction. And even, I think, not just for people, but for the things that people have made. So when we encounter something, I think automatically we're going, did someone make this? You know, is this natural? Is it made by a person? Is there some evidence of human interaction with this thing? And it's kind of automatic. And then when we decide, and this is almost instantaneous, we then find a window into things that have been made by hand. And we believe that things that are made by hand are unique. You know, this is a unique pot, this is a unique plate, a unique carving. But really, we're in this bizarre cultural phase of development where we have things like this, which looks like it's made of wood, but it's actually cast resin. It's got all of that gesture, all of that, you know, seeming emotion, etc. But it was, and someone made an original one, and then they made a cast, and they make multiples to sell as gifts at the airport in Vietnam or something. And we're full of things like that. It's possible to fake it, to mimic a lot of the things we think of as essential for handmade stuff. And it's not that copies are bad. I mean, we think of bronze like this is Rodin. You know, he made a clay original or maybe a plaster original, and then it's reproduced in bronze, and it captures all of that information, all of that hand information, all of that expression. So it's not that something's fundamentally wrong with that. And so that was a bit of a, you know, roundabout way to get back to this question of what kind of homes can our hands give us that maybe we cannot be given in any other way. And this is kind of prompted by seeing an exhibition by an American fiber artist named Sheila Hicks. There's a small exhibition in Tokyo. She became well known in the 60s and 70s at a time when fiber art was not considered art, it was craft. And she has a small work, it's about this big. It's a series she calls Mini. She lives in France and made these small works, and it's called Autumn. And she has these beautiful twigs included in the weaving, and the weave changes from very regular to irregular, accommodating these natural forms. And I thought, yeah, this is woven. And so much of what makes Japanese houses beautiful struck me as the aspect that they are somehow woven together, and both literally and figuratively, and in terms of experience. So we go back to this picture, and we see, of course, this takekomai is kind of like woven from material, and she's weaving possibly something from the floor. And these weaving techniques, of course, basket weaving, it was so developed in Japan, other parts of Asia, actually all around the world, and using these materials, using these weaving techniques, technically to make implements that are both beautiful and both usable. This is a Meiji period factory, not so different from some large productions that we saw in the Edo period. And of course, it's kind of, people point out that here's the women doing the work and the supervisors are men and they're standing around. So this was part of life, these methods of weaving, these methods of doing things. Many materials would lend themselves to being woven. It was kind of an instinctual way. If I have these materials, is there some way I can interlock them, interweave them, make them into layers, make them into some way that they can be curved, or they can be straight, or they can take different forms? And it's not just the physical elements themselves. I mean, I like this photo. It's in Nagano and Sumoko-juku, with the smoke, actually the space seems to be woven three-dimensionally. You're inside this sort of mesh, the light and shadow, which is somehow generated by the form of the buildings, by the structure, by the windows, by the lattices. I love this photo too. It's a photographer named Takumi Ota. Probably took a lot of time figuring out. It's a chashitsu in Kyoto, and so much of it. I mean, the actual takekomai, various windows, these tatami, even the roof, the ceilings, they're all literally woven, and the result is a space that feels like it's woven around you through these various surfaces and various materials. And this goes back very, very far. This is the Heian era painting or drawing, and this is actually interesting because it's one of the first representations of tatami. But there's the tatami, there is the sudare, there's the net, the mosquito net around his bed, they're sleeping, they're covered with kimono, there's literal figural textiles and woven things surrounding them. Their entire, everything they touch basically is somehow a textile. And also the space itself is woven. And tatami, of course, are remarkable. Right? We all deal with them. We're very familiar with them. This is a very nice one at Enkoji. This is a well-known photograph from the Meiji period of the tatami craftsmen. And basically, they can still be made in this old traditional way with the same materials, the same structure, although it's getting more expensive, of course, harder to find the right qualities of igusa grass, etc. And of course, we have a lot of tatami now that have styrofoam for insulation in the middle, and a lot of corner cutting, and a lot of them now coming from China, especially using igusa from China, which is different, and it's harvested at a different time, so it's not as durable necessarily, and a lot of the quality of tatami literally has to do with how it's woven, how the cover surfaces are woven. So to me, it's really interesting. I don't know if Miyoko-san talked yesterday about the fact that there are certain, the highest quality of tatami, the people who actually make the edges of that there's like only one person left in Japan who can do that, which is where we are. And it's not the only example of that. I hope you're able to have lots of other examples of things where, wow, you thought there'd be a lot of people still doing this. But, I mean, you have the machine, maybe had a lot of normal stuff, but the highest quality, from the highest quality temples or palaces, there's almost nobody who knows how to do that anymore. And one thing I love about tatami is that they're, traditionally, they're recyclable. They go back to the farm field as mulch or something. That's kind of great. There's other kinds of floors and things that to me struck me as woven. This is kind of called Sugaki Yuka. You may have seen they're not that common. This is at the Nihon Mika end in Kawasaki, a house from Ehime. And of course, it's bamboo, which has lots of great advantages. I mean, it's kind of, uncomfortable under your feet normally, but if you put Mushiro or Goza on top of it, again, put a soft woven thing on top of a very stiff woven surface, it becomes very, very comfortable and fairly, very inexpensive. So I like that. And then things like Shitajimado, which of course, we associate with tea houses, with chashitsu, sort of an intentional rusticization, maybe in country, maybe emerged from this idea, oh, the wall broke, and we can see the komai inside, and oh, we just leave that for a window. That's the kind of, I think, thinking behind it. And they actually can be quite beautiful and very intentionally detailed to enhance that awareness of how the structure is woven together. And we know that structure goes through the rest of the house. And there's quite a few other names. So I saw this photo, I thought, yeah, okay, it's not really a window, but this is sort of where it came from. And I don't know if you all had the same experience the first time you were in a house under construction where the takakomai was all in place before the wall clay is there. You just go, wow, this is an incredibly beautiful thing, just like it is. It shapes the space, it shapes the light, it's making this beautiful sort of dazzling, shimmering wall surface, and then you know that it's going to become invisible. It's going to be covered up. Like so many things in Japanese culture, the beautiful things are then covered up or then hidden. So this, again, it's less common now. I don't know what percentage of walls in Japan are made this way anymore. We're all using wallboard and plywood for 99%, I'm sure, but it's still something that we can do. And then this kind of light quality, it reminds me of koshi, lattice screens, which are, again, ubiquitous in Japanese buildings of all sorts. And sometimes they're very, very dressy. Some of you have been to Kanazawa's Higashi Chayagai, the geisha district, and the front facades, the walls are all covered with these very, very beautifully, finely made koshi. They're really proud that the koshi in Kanazawa are even more delicate than the ones in Kyoto. And when you look into this, actually, for the koshi in different kinds of merchant houses, particularly in Kyoto, configurations where some of them, not all of the koshi go to the very top, there'll be like gaps. Like three, then one, three, then one, three, then one, to allow light in. And depending on the number, what kind of business it is. So this is really, really interesting that these things themselves speak to us about the identity of the people living and working there. And again, the koshi particularly generates this three-dimensional light, which I think is really, really remarkable and something we can always take advantage of. Sudare, these are just so mundane, we can go to the home center and buy them, or we can have nice ones. They're so simple, so obvious to use. Maybe you've seen it at the temples or shrines, something called misu. This kind of sudare is called a misu, which actually is integrated with beautifully like brocaded textile. So it really is a textile curtain, part of which is made of sudare, and it can be very, very elegant. And that's kind of a nice thing about it, that it then brings us to sudare shoji. Sudare shoji, so also known as natsu shoji. So these are, for the summertime, replacing the paper shoji with ones made of sudare material. So the same thing, and the breeze can go through. There's enough privacy, but they also generate a nice kind of quality of light. Makes a kind of a nice filter, a nice screen for the light. And they can be, also very finely The Koshihita or other parts can be made like Rama. They can be made with wonderful decorations and can be very elegant. At the same time, they're kind of rustic. So this is a beautiful thing which I see less and less of. Often I used to go to a historical house or something like a Chaya Geisha house or something to actually see them. And of course, Kayabuki. Many of us are obsessed with Kayabuki. It's a wonderful problem for all of us. And I think this is Nishio-san, he's here today, in Miyama. And of course, we know that Kayabuki, basically, the Kaya is sort of put in place and then tied, and the whole thing is almost like a big woven futon on top of the house. And it's interesting because, as we know, it fell out of use because of fire problems, and then the craftsmen basically disappeared. But my understanding is that when Shirakawa Go, the Gasho Zukuri farmhouses in Shirakawa Go were made into UNESCO World Heritage, then it became necessary to train people to do this restoration and to be able to do Kayabuki. So there was large training programs, and people would come from all over the country to learn how to do that. So now I think we're fortunate that in most parts of Japan, there are craftsmen who can do it again. Of course, there's the cost problems, there's the fire problems, there's a lot of other issues. I think there's less diversity now to Kayabuki design and technique compared to, let's say, even Meiji period, certainly compared to Edo period, because there's sort of the unified sort of learning the similar methods, and not enough examples of older styles are extended and visible for us to learn from. But yeah, it's really, they take the big, wood or bamboo needle, and they're pushing the rope through, and the woman's down there pulling it and pushing it back. So it's this big sewing thing, it's really a gigantic textile on the roof. And of course, beams in our wonderful farmhouses are often woven together. And this is, again, one of the aspects that most of us love the most. I wish I knew where this photo came from. I found it online. It's a Jinja. So this is probably the no stage of a Jinja in the countryside. But it's just a remarkable example of this kind of beam work, this kind of harigumi. And both the visualization of that and the actual effort and time and skill to be able to do that, and then how we experience that. This is something that you really can't put into words. We feel it in our body. And of course, it happens with all sorts of levels. This is a minka in Massachusetts being done by Komika Collective, I believe. And there's different kinds of structure, different kinds of wooden structure, and making this very beautifully complex, again, interlocking woven structure of wood. There's so much variety to this too. We think, Japanese architecture, minko, whatever, there's a certain kind, but no, there's incredible variety. This is a house in Izu, which has this typical nuki structure, this wonderful lattice grid that goes up, so it's really three-dimensional, orthogonal, kind of rational, but above the wonderful sort of rough curved beams going very, very high up. And even at the very top, there's the sasu, or the moya, basically lashed together. Of course, this is a wonderful aspect, this use of rope to connect wooden members. We see this very much in minka, especially ones that have the kind of roof called sasu, with these large beams of the sasu going up and lashed together. And again, this, point out, this goes back very, very far. This is basically Jomon period technology, going back to the prehistoric era, where all they had was like wooden rope. They figured out how to make comfortable houses with that. I'm going a bit fast. And then I started looking at ceilings and things like, this is often in tea houses, something like the sudari tenjo. So it's a ceiling made like a sudari. And there's also variations. So the ajiro being woven, thin strips of cedar woven together, which could be just a basket. It's literally a basket on the ceiling, and there's incredible variations. And this one is not exactly sudari. It doesn't have the strings of a sudari. It's called a gamatenjo. And this is a particular kind of ajiro, Sugi Masayabune Aijiro. So it's a bit delicate. Lots of variations of roofs and ceilings in Japanese architecture, most of whom depend on what is the actual surface and what to what degree are the structural supports. How are they used? How are they articulated? And here we have actually several layers going together to make this katekomi tenjo. And your normal ceiling, sawabuchi tenjo. This is just every ceiling that we encounter, basically. It's got the sao going there and the flat boards, but there's incredible variations on that. And finally, go tenjo. This is a bit more formal, a bit more, you know, upscale, with actually a grid. It's harder to make. The wood needs to be jointed together and the boards fit in very beautifully. This is actually a restoration in Miyazaki by an architect in Yamada, which I thought was really, really beautiful. So go tenjo. Anyway, as you're looking at this stuff, were you like playing back in your mind how they were made? Like when I showed the bamboo with the little ropes on it, you're sort of going, Or if you saw the woven cedar ajiro tenjo, you're imagining someone weaving it together. How does that go? How does it go? Because we do this automatically, pretty much. It's playing back in our mind. And I guess what I really, I feel so important is that all of this kind of work, it's conveys a special inner experience. It's about what the person making it is experiencing it. And then we share that when we are seeing it, living with it, touching it. It comes to us. And unfortunately, this sort of experience is getting less and less common. So little of what we live with, our environment, allows us to have that experience. And I think, you know, I've said before, the most valuable things, most valuable lessons are the invisibles. You know, it's not about ending up with something. It's about how you learn, how you know, how you experience. And I would just add, part of this, in this case, of almost all of the things I just showed you, is rooted in the fact that the materials and the parts that are being made are renewable, intended to be renewed, intended to be revisited, intended to be repaired, intended to be retouched again and again and again over generations. So when I ask, what are we preserving? I want to say it's that inner experience and the awareness and understanding that there is this kind of inner experience available to us, which is incredibly enriching. Most people probably don't care. I think it's important to put our life and our work in this long, thousand-year frame of reference. And when I ask, who is it for? I'm going to say it's not for us. That I read a wonderful book called The Good Ancestor, which is about society. Our societies and cultures have been based on previous generations doing things for our benefit, doing things for the benefit of people who come later. And this is a motivation for me. Now, it doesn't mean everybody has to carry this heavy weight, but for me, it clarifies what it is we're doing and why it's important. So that's the end of this part. Thank you. And yeah, because I was talking with members of the board earlier, a month or so ago when I was thinking about my talk, and last time we talked about the idea of making a ranking system for Minka and why that would be important, and I've talked about this with Takeshi-san quite a lot, and we haven't quite gotten it up and running yet. But the idea, the overall purpose, is to have information available for anybody interested in Minka to know what exists where and in what condition around the whole country, right? But strategically, the big issue is the lack of support from government for restoration of things like Minka. Government, like so many bureaucracies, demands evidence of some sort, right? They want evidence. They want to know why. Why is this important? And this is the strategic purpose, is to get a sort of database, a body of information that basically anybody can use to present to their local government or their professional government or whoever to say, yes, this house is important and it should be preserved and you should provide resources to do it. And it doesn't happen instantly. And when we're thinking about it and discussing how this could work, it should be a system that can be used in the field. Oh, you're going down the street, you're hiking, oh, look at this wonderful minka, and you can enter some information maybe using your phone. But also there's a lot of people who don't want to do that. They just want to have a piece of paper they can write on and check boxes or something and do it that way. And ideally, we think it should be crowdsourced. This should be just anybody can contribute. Should be open. It doesn't belong to anybody. It's open data, openly available. People can use it freely. It should be online. I mean, that's our era. Things can be available online. Should be bilingual, maybe multilingual. So people vote in Japanese or in English or other languages can make use of it. The big question is what information should be included? And this is kind of where things kind of get tricky. There are some sensitive issues like privacy. Like if I'm going down the street and taking a photo of somebody's house, is it okay for me to include that in this database without their permission? Or should they be involved? Is it okay to have information that may reflect the financial value of something that could have privacy concerns over others? And also the need for people who would be advisors or moderators to go through all these submissions and see if they're all done well or okay. And just for the basic thing, and I would like to hopefully continue, and maybe during the Minka Masters talk, we can talk about this some more. Of course, we imagine to be ranked like 1 to 5 stars and some reasons why, a basic summary. Wonderful old house in a beautiful environment, in great condition, you know, rank 4, you know. Maybe notable points. Oh, it's historically significant, it's rare, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Maybe we should include photos, I think so. Maybe if there's plans should be included. Notes about materials, basic information, where it is, how old it is, what type it is. I mean, this is something that we have to work out what types are included. The condition, is it falling apart? Is it in great shape? Is it occupied? Is it abandoned? And then maybe information about who has contributed the information. So I think our community is perfectly situated to quickly make a significant database of this kind of information. And, you know, I hope that I have more to show you by this time, but I don't. But I hope we can continue this discussion and get feedback from people, particularly about what they think should be included in this sort of thing. I guess that's the real end. I think I'm going to be out of time now. Is that correct?
Yes.
We're done with this. Yeah.
Thanks for joining. What did you think of ASBE's ideas about beauty, handcrafted things, and how we connect to them as humans to enhance both our living spaces, but also to enhance our lives? I really appreciated his insights. As always, you can get in touch with me, an inbound ambassador, at gmail.com. See you next time.